Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours.
Well, thank you for joining me on this beautiful Saturday afternoon, or at least afternoon for me. I have just a few things that I want to touch on today, one of which is centered around Venezuela, but as well as things that are going on in Yemen, which is something I talk about quite a bit, the Saudis continuing to attack, as well as a new arm of government that was essentially created that no one seems to be aware of that happened over Thanksgiving, and some horrible things happening in Israel. But let's begin with essentially what has been the ongoing effort to create the justification for the regime change, U.S.-based regime change in Venezuela, something we've been seeing take place for a very long time. Now, this, of all the topics today, I want to spend the most time on. It's the first one I'm going to start with. And I truly think that this is very important for us to understand not just where this is going, but how we got here and how this relates to U.S. policy from before, from decades ago. And on a side note, interestingly, ties in with this idea of these ships that were posted off the coast of Venezuela, which is relevant in this regard. But the first article of the day, indeed, one of the better articles I've read in quite a while, at least in regard to this topic, on really summing up all the information, most of which I'm going to try to cover in a short period of time to begin with today. This coming from Counterpunch, entitled, Business as Usual, Washington's Regime Change Strategy in Venezuela. And this really is an excellent article, and I truly hope that you will all, as usual, take time to read each one of these for yourself and come to your own conclusions, because I never want you to simply hear what I have to say and take that as the facts. I want you to always, always do your own research and come to your own conclusions based on the information that's presented. But as you know, I will never shy away from giving you my opinion, and even emotionally sometimes, as it were, because that's what's important. I want you guys to see what I think about this, but please come to your own conclusions. Now, this is easily one of the, in my opinion, one of the biggest things that are coming in regard to foreign policy. But it's kind of hard to weigh which one's bigger, and we're talking about Iran, the continuation of the Idlib offensive in Syria. There's a lot of big things happening right now. But this one I do feel is very important. Now, Washington's strategy of regime change in Venezuela is almost identical to the approach it's taken in Latin America on numerous occasions since World War II. This strategy involves, as we've talked about extensively on this show, economic sanctions, extensive support for the opposition, and destabilization measures that create enough human suffering and chaos in their eyes to justify a military coup or direct U.S. military intervention. For Washington, this is simply business as usual in Latin America and many other places. But to understand that this is creating hardship for the very people they pretend to be fighting for to justify what they want at the end, which has nothing to do with what's best for the people. We should hopefully be seeing this by now. Now, despite U.S. rhetoric, this regime change strategy does not take into account whether or not a government is democratically elected or the human rights consequences of the interventions, as we can see in places like Libya and Afghanistan and Iraq that are very clearly worse off for these actions. Now, in fact, virtually all of the Latin American governments that the United States has successfully overthrown over the past 65 years were actually democratically elected. Among the democratically elected leaders that have been ousted were, I believe, it's Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954, Salvador Allende in Chile in 1973, Jean-Bertrand Aristide in Haiti in 2004, and Manuel Zelaya in Honduras in 2009. Clearly seeing that these things happened right up in our recent past, not some, back in the 60s and the 70s, these things are happening frequently right up until today. Now, Washington targeted all of these leaders with economic sanctions and destabilization campaigns that created the economic chaos and humanitarian crises required to justify a military solution in their eyes. The common denominator in all of these cases had absolutely nothing to do with democracy or human rights. It was the fact that those elected governments had the audacity to challenge U.S. interests in the region, the audacity to put their people's interests before that of the U.S. elite. The fact that a Latin American government might prioritize its interests of its own people over the U.S. needs is unacceptable in Washington. And as usual, as we are seeing in Venezuela and many others, Washington ramps up its support for opposition groups on the ground regardless of what they may be about or what they represent, similar to what we can see in Ukraine, with gross serious neo-Nazis. They don't care because it helps their agenda, but they ramp up their support for these opposition groups on the ground through increased funding of these Trojan horse NGOs, something that James Corbett has touched on quite a bit, such as USAID, with the objective of turning people against the government. And what's really sick and disgusting about these NGOs, such as USAID and many others, or like the National Endowment for Democracy is a big one, is the idea that these people, they go in there with this guise of trying to help the humanitarian aid, when in reality, they're just a thin veneer for U.S. regime change and just U.S. foreign policy in general, which is pretty disgusting and deceitful when you realize it. Now, in 2015, President Obama signed a presidential order ludicrously stating that Venezuela posed an extraordinary threat to national security for the United States, which I touched on at the time and I've referenced a few times since. But without that wildly false order, the U.S. would not have legally been able to impose sanctions on Venezuela. 2 years later, President Donald Trump stated that he would not rule out a military option for Venezuela, which also made headlines. Now, earlier this month, President Trump tightened the screws even more by signing an executive order imposing sanctions on gold exports for Venezuela. The South American nation contains the second largest gold reserves, similar to one of the largest oil reserves. Interesting why, you know, that obviously plays a part in this, and has turned to actually selling some of their gold as a means of addressing the economic crisis, which is kind of sad when you realize that they're forced to selling off their assets to counteract the crisis created by U.S. foreign policy. Now, 1 week after Trump issued his decree, Britain complied with the new sanctions by actually refusing to hand over 14 tons of gold bars worth about $550 million back to Venezuela. Now, this gold actually belongs to Venezuela and is simply being stored in the vaults of the Bank of England, as is the case with the billions of Citgo's oil profits, Citgo being a Venezuela company, that the U.S. sanctions actually block from being sent back to Venezuela. Venezuela simply wants what is rightfully theirs, and these profits and these gold are their assets. Now, they claim, at least the guys, is, oh, well, we're worried because he's a dictator, mind you, that he's going to sell these things and do it for, you know, and profit on his own. It has nothing to do with the people. But that counters the reality of the situation. Of course, also primarily that he was democratically elected, which they argue, and I'll get more into that in a moment. Now, the fact that the United States and Britain specifically feel that they have the right to decide what Venezuela can and cannot do with its own assets and reserves really illustrates the imperialist arrogance of these two nations, as well as others. Now, worse yet, earlier this week, it was revealed that the Trump administration is considering actually adding Venezuela to the list of U.S. state sponsors of terror, or rather, excuse me, the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism, which would automatically trigger even harsher sanctions, which is largely the point. Labeling Venezuela as a state sponsor of terrorism is about as ludicrous as Obama declaring the country to be an extraordinary threat of U.S. national security. They're both demonstrably false and easily verifiable, but they've never really stopped them in the past, and it's not going to stop them now. Now, I mean, it's just like they call Iran the state sponsor of terrorism, and there's no proof to make that claim. Yet the U.S. has never needed proof to intervene in another country. A move like this really illustrates the length to which Washington is absolutely willing to go to get what it wants. Laws, rights, and human lives be damned. Now, these corrupt U.S. efforts are being coordinated with the opposition in Venezuela, like we've just noted on, which mostly consists of the country's wealthy elites that really run the economy. And were really, rather, they ran the economy primarily before the election of Hugo Chavez, or rather just the country in general. Now, the socialist policies of Chavez and Maduro have really infringed on the privileges enjoyed by these elites, and by also, as it really does matter, foreign oil companies. Now, that you have to understand that them coming in and doing things for the people hurt their ability to just do whatever they want and profit wildly while doing it. Of course, in response, these U.S.-backed corporate elites have sought to sabotage the economy by scaling back production and by exporting much-needed basic necessities to neighboring Colombia. All these necessities they claim are nowhere to be found, the shelves are empty, blaming socialism, which you could argue plays a factor. But you also can't ignore the very clear effort of U.S.-backed or at least collaborating with these elites to make this the case. All of this is in conjunction with U.S. efforts to actually hurt the population for their own ends. Now, despite its wealth and economic power, the Venezuelan opposition really needs the support of the U.S. because it can't win in the ballot box. Since 1998, in election after election, Venezuelans have overwhelmingly supported President Chavez and Maduro at the polls. These elections have been monitored, mind you, which people argue, by international observers, as I've often cited about the recent one, and have repeatedly been deemed free and fair. And those that argue that's not true, in fact, one famous election observer, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, said, quote, "As a matter of fact, of the 92 elections that were monitored, I would say that the election process in Venezuela is the best in the world." I mean, I guess that's just fake news, but it's funny that people ignore these very obvious and easily researchable concepts. They've been monitored and, in fact, are deemed democratic, despite all the U.S. rhetoric. Now, the U.S. mainstream media, of course, is playing its customary propaganda role by ensuring that the public only hears the official Washington narrative, which seeks to demonize the Venezuelan government and has repeatedly labeled both Chavez and Maduro as undemocratic, authoritarian, and as, of course, dictators. The media has also focused attention on the food shortages and the humanitarian crisis, failing, of course, to mention that it was largely orchestrated by the U.S. agenda and these Venezuelan economic elites that are intentionally withholding and selling their goods elsewhere. It's just absurd to not factor that into this discussion, or I should say it's wildly dishonest and disingenuous of them to give you only a fraction of the story. But see, that's the point. Now, meanwhile, the fact that more than 5 million people in neighboring Colombia, where they're selling their goods, were forcibly displaced from their homes by violence over the past couple of decades barely registered a blip on the mainstream media radar. Nor has the fact that more than 4,000 indigenous Wayuu children have died from malnutrition in northern Colombia over the past decade. We don't hear about these crises because the Colombian government, in fact, is a friendly regime that serves U.S. interests, as are many other authoritarian allies whose human rights violations are conveniently ignored by the mainstream media. Washington's regime change strategy in Venezuela is really nothing new. I think that should be shockingly apparent to most today, as we can see this copy and paste effort taking place all over the world. But Latin America is quite obvious, despite the obvious rhetoric of people like Nikki Haley and Mike Pence literally calling out that they need regime change in these countries, people still fail to recognize it. Now, in fact, it's virtually a carbon copy of what's happening in Venezuela of previous regime change efforts in Latin America. One classic example occurred in Chile after socialist candidate Salvador Allende was elected president in 1970. CIA Director Tenet stated, quote, "I don't see why we need to stand by and watch a country go communist due to the irresponsibility of its people. The issues are much too important for the Chilean voters to be left to decide for themselves. God forbid they should actually vote in a democracy." And so the Nixon administration set about destabilizing the country, which hurt those very people, with policies that sought to, as one cabinet member actually stated, quote, "make the Chilean economy scream." For 18 months after that, the CIA secretly funded businesses, shop owners, and truck drivers to actually shut down and go on strike. Mind you, these are things like today we would see in Venezuela that they would blame on socialism or the dictator government, when in fact we see CIA secretly funding these things behind the scenes, or largely today it ends up being the NGOs, such as the National Endowment for Democracy or USAID, as they've openly stated in recent years that they now do overtly what the CIA used to do covertly. This is all out there for everyone to very easily research. And of course, they successfully made the economy scream as they wanted to by causing hardships for the Chilean people who had to endure massive shortages of basic necessities. Does that sound familiar to anyone? More than just Venezuela, you could make this case exactly like that for, off the top of my head, like 3 or 4 countries that are right out in front of us. Basic shortages of necessities they blame on the government. Now, declassified documents reveal that the United States also actually provided funding and weapons, mind you, to the opposition groups in Chile, while CIA operatives worked with Chilean military officers who were actually planning a coup to overthrow President Allende. By 1973, Chile had destabilized sufficiently enough in their eyes to justify a military coup, which this was much easier back in 1973 when there was no internet. It's much different for them today. Now, once in power, the coup leader that they put in place, General Augusto Pinochet, which many of you may be familiar with, reversed many of Allende's policies that had hurt the interests, of course, of the country's elites and U.S. corporations. He also ruled Chile as a dictator for the next 18 years, with Washington's backing as he basically turned the country into a human rights catastrophe. But now it's okay because they're doing what the U.S. wants. It just shows you this entirely hollow narrative about saving the people. A similar process unfolded in Haiti, which Haiti, there's so many things we could talk about, following the election of a Catholic priest, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, I believe, to the presidency in 2000, not that long ago. His political party, I believe it's Fanmi Lavalas, was by far the most popular in Haiti and gained a significant majority in the country's parliament. As the elected leader of the hemisphere's most impoverished country, Aristide implemented policies that benefited the poor in the areas of healthcare, education, and low-cost housing. God forbid. He also doubled the minimum wage, which, of course, infringed on the profits garnered by U.S., Canadian, and French companies operating in the country, likely operating there because they could benefit so much. Washington and its imperialist allies responded by, as usual, imposing economic sanctions on Haiti while simultaneously funding opposition groups in the country. Business as usual. God forbid they should do things for the people. Now, U.S. aid, as we just talked about, managed much of the opposition funding and actively campaigned against the raising of the minimum wage. The U.S. aid, a humanitarian group out there protesting and campaigning against the raise of minimum wage for the average people. Think of how absurdly contradictory that is, and just outside their scope. Now, Aristide also faced a campaign of violence waged by paramilitary groups that were funded by France and Haiti's economic elites. Declassified documents actually revealed that these armed groups maintained a clear relationship with the United States. In 2004, with the country reduced to absolute chaos following 3 years of economic sanctions and paramilitary violence, the United States, Canada, and France, which I think is very relevant that those two countries worked together with them, deployed actual troops to Haiti to literally overthrow the government. U.S. Marines actually seized President Aristide and his wife in the presidential palace and transported them to the international airport, which had been secured by Canadian troops. All this happening in a sovereign country, mind you. The Haitian president was forced to resign from office under the barrel of a gun and flown with his wife to Africa. I mean, this is U.S. policy. This is what they do. Invade a country and forcefully remove a democratically elected leader. The United States then, of course, installed a Haitian businessman who lived in Miami and is as the new unelected president, because that seems like it suits the needs of the people. With the country existing under foreign military occupation, the new president reversed basically most of the policies implemented by the previous president, imprisoned thousands of opponents, and banned the past president's party, which was in fact the most popular political party in the country. So reversed everything that was good for the people and got rid of the party that everybody supported. Democracy. Now, the current U.S. foreign policy towards Venezuela clearly replicates policies implemented in the past decades that, in their eyes, successfully ousted governments in Latin America. From Washington's perspective, it makes perfect sense to implement policies that undermine a democratically elected government in order to achieve regime change when that government prioritizes the needs of its own people over those of the U.S. economy and multinational corporations. The strategy worked in Chile. It worked in Haiti. And it also worked in many other countries around the world the U.S. has illegally overthrown. The United States has no qualms about undermining democracy and imposing economic hardships on average civilians over and over. And this time, with the Venezuelan people, the target in order to achieve regime change in that country. So we're talking about hurting the Venezuelan people, the very people they're pretending to be fighting for, in order to achieve their goals. It's very simple. I guess a country isn't truly democratic unless its government has, you know, the interests of the United States at heart. And this is something we really need to recognize as this continues to go forward. especially if Trump does in fact list them as a state sponsor of terrorism. But I challenge anyone that disagrees with this stuff to do their research, look up all the things we just talked about, and tell me any one of those are incorrect. And these aren't just from the 1670s, as I pointed out. These are recent, maybe just a decade past, that are very clearly exactly what we're seeing take place. And they truly, truly have such little faith in your ability to have any memory at all or do any research, because it's really that simple to see that this is exactly what they're doing. This is not okay with me. I don't know about the rest of you watching out there that are Americans. This is not okay with me that our tax dollars go to do this. But this is the way it is. This is business as usual, which is why we need a change. And hopefully you out there can help me in creating that. And moving on to the next story, coming from ZeroHedge.com, one that I feel is important in regard to the illusion of change, which they always try to force on us. This entitled, "Everyone Not Exporting Arms to Saudi Arabia is Halting Arms Exports to Saudi Arabia." Clearly trying to make a joke of the fact that all these people are standing up and saying, "We're stopping our arms sales to Saudi Arabia," when in fact they really weren't selling arms that much at all to Saudi Arabia anyway. Which doesn't make it a bad thing. It is nice to see people make that statement. But is that what's happening, or they're using this as a way to manipulate our perception to think that they are doing something when in fact, not much at all is happening? Now, these new pieces are being written on many different outlets about the, quote, latest countries to suspend new arms deals with Saudi Arabia, and are actually very deceptive, given that some of these countries' arms exports to Saudi Arabia were so minuscule to begin with that it hardly warrants any kind of celebration. CNN, of course, reports Denmark and Finland on Thursday became the latest countries to suspend new arms deals with Saudi Arabia. Denmark's foreign ministry said it was freezing new deals over both Khashoggi and Yemen, while the Finnish foreign minister mentioned only Yemen. Finland also banned new arms sales to the United Arab Emirates, which is part of the Saudi-led coalition in the conflict, which I really like, by the way. Even if this is a deception, I like the fact that these countries, especially even Finland, that's only saying, well, Yemen is really all that matters here, that they're making a statement. And this could be indicative of the fact that we are making a difference and these people are realizing what's really happening. And even if they're not selling that much to them, they're anyway just saying, well, we're going to make a political statement and say we don't agree with what's happening there. And that's a fantastic thing. But what's not fantastic is the way groups like CNN and the other mainstream media groups are making this into something that it's not. It goes on to say their announcement came just 2 days after Germany said it was stopping all arms transfers to the kingdom, which, in fact, we've heard before, and they just didn't follow through with. So hopefully they do. But despite European nations over the past years, since the start of the 2015 U.S.-backed Saudi coalition air campaign over Yemen, steadily decreasing their arms exports to Saudi Arabia by the multiple tens of millions, the overall value of Saudi arms imports, in fact, actually increased by 38%. So you see, they want you to be like, look at all these people who are stopping their sales, which is good, but it actually increased by 38%. And guess why that is? This was almost entirely because of a huge uptick in transfers from none other than the United States, which almost doubled its exports in terms of value from $1.8 billion to $3.4 billion. Now, however, Denmark and Finland announced that the few existing contracts in place would not be canceled, which kind of frustrated me because they're saying we're going to halt these deals, but the ones that we already have going on, we're going to keep going with, which I get to some degree. You want to honor your agreements, but we're talking about the genocide of an entire race of people. If you really cared about what's happening and you really think that they're breaking the, you know, international norms and committing war crimes, then pull it. No more. We're canceling the deals we have. I mean, that's what I would want to do, but you know, these are governments, they're politicians. Take what you can get. Now, over the past half decade, the U.S. accounted for 61% of major arms sales to Saudi Arabia, with the U.K. a distant second with 23% share, and France in third with a mere 4%. So it's very clear, again, to make the point resoundingly clear, that the U.S. is predominantly supporting the Saudi-led attack on basically civilians, in large part, in Yemen. 61% of their arms sales. And they want you to think that it's slowing down. Now, again, I want to reiterate, it's nice to see people standing up and making that statement, and I support them doing that. But the reality is that they've actually increased how much weapons they're getting because of the United States. And guess whose tax dollars support that? Take a wild guess. Sadly, due to the fact that all they really need is U.S. support, as we can see, to be able to carry on their genocidal invasion of Yemen, after seeing the recent statement released by President Donald Trump, the absurdly false statement, the Saudis have clearly taken that as a green light to carry on, as it seems it was meant to be, at least I think, in addition to making wildly false claims about Iran, as usual. So, in a very related story coming from Geopolitics Alert, written by Randy Nord, as always, an excellent, excellent report by Randy Nord, entitled, With reaffirmed U.S. support, Saudis continue assault on Yemen and attacks on civilians. Which, of course, I reported on, we already kind of knew this was happening. They bombed a political member. This has been going. They never really stopped. As Hussein al-Bukhadi continues to say, there is no ceasefire. It never stopped. But the point is, there was a shift in discussion, and now because of this statement he put out, the Saudis have increased their attacks. And they're continuing to go over the top more than ever because they felt like they got the green light. And clearly that seemed like exactly what it was. Now, on November 20th, we know the White House issued a statement blaming Iran for the ongoing bloodshed in Yemen, which is ludicrous. And even in the midst of the UN-backed peace talks, and the Houthis taking clear steps to de-escalate, demonstrably, the Saudis instead took this as the very clear green light that I think it was to continue these attacks on civilians in Yemen. I mean, on Yemen. But it's clear the civilians are the aspect that I'm focusing on, that they are continuing to bomb civilian areas. Now, despite the UN's envoy, the UN envoy's actual presence, which there's a UN envoy in Yemen, the Saudi coalition continued their attacks on these areas, risking there's a UN envoy, and they still carried out these attacks on the area. On Thursday, coalition warplanes targeted a house in Hodeidah's Kilo 16 area, killing at least three civilians. U.S.-backed coalition attacks also destroyed civilian homes and farms in Sada province on Thursday. On Friday, the Saudi coalition launched at least 15 airstrikes across various areas of Sada province, destroying more farms and homes. Today, a spokesman from the Ministry of Defense announced that the coalition, the U.S.-backed Saudi coalition, 61% U.S.-backed Saudi coalition, had launched 47 raids, 47, on various provinces over just the past 24 hours. Think about that. Now, is that not a clear escalation based on their green light? He pointed out that the forces of aggression clearly have no desire to achieve peace. I think that's pretty damn clear. Now, if we needed any more evidence to back that up, Hussein al-Bukhadi just reached out before the show from the ground to point out exactly this. A massive Saudi-UAE coalition attack on Hodeidah City. More than 70 strikes and artillery shelling on neighborhoods in Road 50 in Hodeidah. Coalition is trying to siege the city. The Ministry of Defense in Sana'a has announced that the coalition has no meaning of peace in Yemen, which we just said. This is real, people. This is actually happening. With all that we know, with the bombings of buses full of children, with all kinds of terrible things that we focused on, that the media, the mainstream and independent media alike, have talked about. People grandstanding. Of course, Khashoggi brings the attention to all this stuff. If not tangentially, they're talking about it at least. And yet they still can't not just continue, but increase their attacks. This is impunity. This is with impunity. This is because of U.S. support. This is what we need to stand against. This is not representative of what we believe we are in this country. This is representative of the grotesquely greedy, malicious U.S. oligarchy. The elite few, and not elite in a good way, are controlling this. They have hijacked our ability to actually govern this country as the American people. Because it's damn clear that nobody wants U.S. troops, which are on the ground in Yemen, despite what they say. It's been recognized by the Associated Press and many other people that this is not okay with us. We cannot be okay with this. And I really hope that this is something we can get across to maybe the new people that come across this channel, that can shake free of the propaganda they see and realize what's really going on there, which is increasingly becoming pretty much the worst humanitarian crisis I've ever seen. Now, on to some domestic news before the last story of the day. This is one I added just before we started. I just wanted to touch on. It's certainly important, but I just had a few notes that I wanted to cover from this story. it's interesting. The most interesting part to me is how this happened without anybody really even being aware of it. This coming from the activist post entitled U.S. Silently Passes and Signs Bill to Create New Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Does that not sound like something that the American people should be involved in? God forbid. Of course, because our Congress was involved, that we're involved. No, because Congress doesn't represent us anymore. They have no obligation to do anything their constituencies actually want unless they're made to look bad or that risks their political career. So all this happened without, and where's the mainstream media? Why was this not discussed? This seems like a pretty damn relevant thing to discuss on a news agency, wouldn't you say? Pretty alarming to me. Now, this bill silently passed through Congress and to the U.S. President, the U.S. President Donald Trump's desk, that was signed right before Thanksgiving last week, which would redesignate the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's National Protection and Programs Directorate, the NPPD, into a new agency called the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, or CISA. Now, the NPPD was just a part of the Homeland Security. So now this is now becoming its own thing, with definitely its own funding. And it's just another black hole for spending for the United States government. The bill known as the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency Act, swiftly passed in Congress in October, and last week, H.R. 335 advanced through the House of Representatives without any resistance and barely any media attention at all. Trump signed the bill into law almost immediately after the legislation passed the House. Of course, because why would we not want to spend more money? Now, the claim is that we need this to protect our cybersecurity because there are so many threats, which is largely true. I mean, this is the future. This is where everything is going. But the real question we should be asking is not simply, do we need to defend ourselves, which is how they want you to think about this, is why the already many groups out there that we already fund, such simply as the Homeland Security, could not handle this themselves. You have to understand that if just simply taking the same amount of funding that they're going to be shoving into this new group and just give it to Homeland Security, to the NPPD, why would that not be the same thing? Why is it necessary to create an entire new arm? The reason being is that this apparatus is so far outside the control of even the White House, as I see it, that it's just another way to create funding for whether it be the military-industrial complex or just government budgets. And it's so frustrating to see this. And hopefully people can recognize not only this stuff happened without us being involved or even being told about it, but it's just, it's government bureaucracy and just the way that this whole apparatus functions is so far outside the control of even the people working within it. Groups, even like we're talking about groups like the CIA and the intelligence community, they operate like rogue nations. They're so far outside the control of the people we think are in control. It's quite alarming. And something like this just really bothered me. So I hope we can look into this more, talk about this more as it develops, but it's quite an alarming development personally with where this is going, and who knows what this group is going to continue to do. Now, moving on to the final story of the day, coming from Global Research, a really sad story coming out of Israel that, you know, it's something that we continue to point out, but how this continues to happen and is okay with everybody else, I mean, clearly because they're being strong-armed by powerful groups like the United States military, but the fact that this continues to happen is really upsetting. It's entitled Evacuation of 700 Palestinians from Their Homes in Occupied East Jerusalem Approved by Israeli Court. Now, of course, remember that these are already displaced people. People that have already been kicked out of their rightful sovereign territory and made to set up in these different settlements. And then now because Israel decides they just don't want any Palestinians in Jerusalem, they're going to continue to kick them out and displace them again. Only democracy in the Middle East. Now, in direct contradiction of the Geneva Conventions, the Israeli Supreme Court has in fact approved the evacuation of 700 Palestinians from their homes in the Silwan neighborhood of East Occupied Jerusalem. The Israeli Supreme Court rejected, probably pretty quickly on Wednesday evening, a petition filed by 104 Palestinians and instead allowed the eviction of the 51 Palestinian families living in the heart of Silwan. The families explained in their petition that the lands are public domain. The lands are public domain lands, and that Israeli association is not entitled to put its hands on it. But Haaretz reported that it's not a private property dispute between the families and the landowners. The eviction efforts are a clear manifestation of Israel's policies toward Palestinians living in Jerusalem. Very clear. So it has nothing to do with anything other than the fact that they don't want Palestinians there. I mean, that how is this even okay? It's only okay because Israel gets away with anything like this because of the United States. They allow them to do this kind of thing, or shouldn't even say it like that. Who knows? It's very clear in my eyes that Israel has much more influence on U.S. than the other way around. But what's clear is the U.S. military and their power is allowing Israel to basically do whatever it wants with impunity. I mean, that should be utterly, staggeringly clear by what's been happening in the Great March of Return, with hundreds of people being murdered for simply protesting. And as we continually point out, if this even happened with one person in, say, Syria or Iran, it would be the biggest deal of the century. But because it's Israel, it gets ignored and stifled and obfuscated. And if you speak out about it, you're an anti-Semitic. This is the reality. And no, as I always make clear on this show, these are the people, both Saudi and Israel, that are the chief allies of the United States. What does that say about the people running this country? You can't ignore these things. These are horrible things that continue to happen. There's no justification. There's no answer for just arbitrarily kicking out for a second time 51 families just because you don't want them there. Has to stay home with us there. That has to really resonate with who these people are. And truly, I hope we can get this information out and wake just one more person up. Just one more every day. Just one more person. And I believe that's a success. So thank you again for tuning in today. Be sure and spread the information. Sadly, I have some obligations, so I won't be able to do a TLEV research and review, but I promise there'll be more coming. I love you all. Stay tuned. And as always, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.